Hello and welcome to Bread and Thread, a podcast about food and domestic history. I'm Liz.
And I'm Hazel, and we are two friends who studied archaeology together and who love history and making things and also baking things that are sometimes historical and sometimes they're not. And we like to start by talking about what we've been making or baking recently. So what's the hat?
Okay. I made panna cotta.
Say again?
I made panna cotta.
Panna cotta? I thought you said panic otter. And that sounded
good. I really freaked out a mustard lid, yeah. Just jumped out of the bushes.
But yes, dessert.
Dessert. Yeah, I made panna cotta because, like, we have this vague idea of doing, like, a big Italian meal after we've moved. And maybe having, like, our parents around and doing that, and it'll be great. Except my mum doesn't have dairy, and Nick's mum's vegetarian, so doesn't have gelatin.
So you have to make a dairy-free vegetarian panna cotta.
That's step two. Step one was just making sure I can actually make it.
Mm-hmm.
And then this weekend I'm going to try and make a version that both our mums can have.
Isn't most of it milk?
Yeah, but you can use a mixture of coconut cream and then a non-dairy milk.
Okay. That sounds good. Is that as hard as it looks?
Not really, to be honest. Like, I thought gelatin would be harder to work with. But the non-gelatin version is going to be harder because you have to boil it to make it work, but also you're boiling dairy, but it's not actually dairy, so it might be okay.
Mm-hmm.
You see why I wanted to make it normal styles first. Just to get the idea.
Yeah, just to figure out how to make it.
Yeah. I've done that, and I've been grinding away at another Stash Buster blanket because I need a thing to do with all of the anxiety.
The house moving feels.
So I've just been crocheting a lot.
Mm-hmm.
Like, since we last recorded, I've done half of a C2C double blanket.
That's pretty good going, even for you. I think since we last recorded, I have done about a third of the back of a jumper.
Knitting, though.
Yeah.
Because that's slower than crochet, isn't it?
Yeah, true.
And I bet you have to follow a pattern and not just go like, I've reached the end, turn it round, go again.
Yeah. I do like a good sort of mindless craft.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, the batwing jumper continues.
Ooh.
It is blue and sparkly, and I'm liking it a lot more than I thought I would. So The progress is slow, but there is progress.
I love the idea of doing it in blue. Like, then you can just become the nighttime.
Yes.
Because night is blue.
Yeah, dark, dark blue.
Yeah.
I mean, I will. That's more the colour. I will send you a picture of the yarn I am using. It's kind of like a deep royal blue with silver threads in.
Yeah, it's like royal blue, but less like in your face than most royal blue.
Yeah, yeah.
Muted royal blue.
Yeah.
I like that.
Yeah, it is hopefully going to be good. And it's been several weeks and I have not given up on it yet. So that is always good.
Yeah.
Hopefully I will have a jumper to show you guys at some point.
Well, we're heading into spring now, so you've got like 6 months.
Yeah, true. But like, it's an evening jumper and I feel like, you know, spring, summer evenings can still get a bit chilly.
That's true.
I mean, I would probably also wear it in the daytime just because sparkles all the time, but
nothing wrong with that.
Anyway, that's pretty much it. Recently, I made a banging cauliflower cheese, but that's not that exciting. So, yeah.
Nick and I have also cooked with cauliflower today.
What manner of cauliflower form?
Cauliflower and harissa pasta sauce.
Oh, that sounds really good.
With pappardelle.
Oh. Was that a recipe or did you make it up?
I just thought they'd taste good together.
Sounds like they would.
They did.
Get confirmed.
There you go.
You heard it here first.
Don't actually know what harissa is. I should look that up and then do an episode about it.
I think I made some once, but I can't remember what was in it.
But in the meantime, what is today's episode?
So I haven't done a thread in a while, I don't think.
I think so.
I was going to talk about smocking and smock frock.
Ooh.
Because I kind of can't really talk about why smocking is called smocking without explaining what a smock frock is.
Yeah, that makes sense.
So, smocking is a technique of gathering fabric in, basically, but in a fancy way. So it's kind of like small pleats, and then there's embroidery on top as well. And it like gathers the fabric in, and depending on the technique you use, it can be a bit elastic as well. So it allows for a bit more movement.
It's that sort of ruffly effect you get on little girls' clothing quite a lot.
Yeah, it is quite popular. I definitely had in the 90s a few like children's outfits with smocking on.
Yeah, there's pictures of me in several like dresses with smocking around sort of the torso part. Bodice, that's what it's called.
Yes. Actually, I'll see if I can find. Because it can be pretty plain or it can be quite fancy. So I'll find a good example of honeycomb smocking because...
I mean, to be fair, it is an audio medium.
That is true. Okay, so there will be pictures on the Tumblr, as per usual, but... So I'm just sending Liz an image of some honeycomb smocking, it can be pretty cool. And usually it's done by like, because you have to like pleat the fabric using embroidery. So normally it's done by sort of marking out dots on the fabric at evenly spaced intervals. And then you'll use that as a guide to get the stitches even and the pleats like evenly spaced. So that's kind of a description of how it's done. I would encourage you to go look at either the pictures on the Tumblr or just go and Google smocking.
I think it's sometimes a Great British Sewing Bee challenge as well, if you have access to that.
Is it? Okay. I think there's a bunch of YouTube videos showing how to do it as well. But yeah, I think it looks pretty cool. I'm a fan.
It reminds me of the like rain type outfits.
Rain outfits.
As in like the show Rain, where it's like,
oh,
we're gonna give the vibes of being like Tudor without it actually being Tudor outfits. You get a lot of that kind of design.
Yeah, the vibes. Yeah, I think it seems kind of old-fashioned to a lot of people just because it got quite popular again in the 70s with the whole sort of folksy revival thing. So, like, I think people today tend to associate it with that. But it's making a comeback. As we will talk about, it has been popular for different sort of uses. For quite a long time. So, smocking in Europe originates kind of in the Middle Ages. A kind of similar techniques are found around the world, but for the ease of the term smocking and the garment, there's a smock frock. I'm going to talk a lot about what can be known as English smocking. And you can see it in images from the medieval period. So, like, there's one of the Virgin and Child where the Virgin Mary is wearing a dress with, like, smocking over the hip to, like, bring the fabric in a bit at that point. It was used on, like, the collars and the cuff as well of, like, undershirts and other garments to adjust them more to the wearer, or, like, to bring all the fabric in at the cuff. And it could be decorative as well as practical. I haven't managed to find any, like, existing examples from that period, really. But there is an image here of a 16th century garment.
So it's, like, all along the neckline.
Later end, yeah. So this sort of diamond pattern all along the neckline, that's helping to bring all that fullness in a little bit. So yeah, getting quite decorative there as well. So it's quite a time-consuming craft, really, especially when done by hand, because, I mean, this is before elastic, so it served a bit of that function as well. But, like, yeah, having to, like, do all those sometimes really tiny pleats by hand and try and make sure they're all even as well. Like, it takes a while. And so some of these look like they're done on really fine linen shirts or something, which is fancy. But it didn't always have to be for fancy uses. As far as I can find out, it continued to be used. You can find it on a lot of folk costumes around Europe. But the reason we know it as smocking is because it became very associated with a particular garment called the smock frock. So a smock initially was like an undergarment, like a shift or a chemise, like just a loose fitting, usually linen, like flowy undergarment. But towards the end of the 18th century, they started to get more like used for men's outerwear, particularly for agricultural workers, to like protect your normal clothes.
Makes sense.
From like the dust and dirt that you would encounter in your work. They can be
so particularly... kind of like a historical overall kind of thing.
Yeah, kind of like overalls. They're these like big flowing garments, usually made of like strong serviceable fabrics like linen or often waxed linen, apparently, to make it a little bit more weatherproof. And the smocking on those was often done with like the strongest thread you could get. A glazed cotton was quite popular, apparently. And so the smocking was used, the stitch was used on those. And it can be known as gauging or biasing. The term smocking only seems to appear in relation to the stitch itself towards the end of the 19th century. But by that point, it had become so associated with that particular garment that the stitch came to be known as smocking, because it was used on smocks. So the smock frocks were worn like throughout the 19th century. There's a lot of examples of them. They can be very plain for like workaday use. They're quite associated with shepherds as well, I think, although other agricultural labourers did wear them. And they can be really plain, or they can be quite fancy. Apparently, you could also get wedding smocks and like church smocks, which I think is quite fun.
I like that. It's almost like you do this thing for practical reasons, and then you go, "Oh, this looks great. Actually, I'm going to do it all the time."
Yeah. So like, it's that particular thing of like, this is a garment to protect your normal clothes. So you would think like, on a special occasion, you wouldn't have to wear it. You would just wear your nice clothes. But because it's such a part of like the identity of the people using it, it's like, no, I'm going to have a fancy version of what I usually wear for work. And I'm going to wear it when I'm being fancy.
I just really love that.
Me too.
It'd be like rocking up to your wedding in like rhinestone dungarees. And now I say that, there's definitely people who've done that.
Oh yeah, I'm sure.
And I love and support them.
I mean, there's a lot of people, like, if they're in like an organization that has a uniform, there are like a dress versions of that uniform that people wear for their wedding, or...
That's true, like military dress uniform is like a whole thing, isn't it?
Yeah. Okay, this one I like. These are some examples from the V&A.
We love the V&A.
Yep. The V&A collections, like, online are fantastic. This one is dated between 1800 and 1849, and it looks quite a fancy one. It's got embroidery as well as, like, fancy smocking. So it's made of linen and it's got pockets. It looks like it's got pockets anyway. And it's got
a massive collar.
Yeah. So it's got, if I can zoom in enough on that embroidery to tell the stitch.
But there's little patches of the smocking on the sleeves. And then like the whole front part. That must have looked great, actually, worn.
Yeah.
It's hard to tell, was it just on a hanger?
I'll see if I can find some pictures of them being worn. Yeah, there's some fantastic pictures of, like, guys holding pitchforks in their cool smock frocks. There's, near where I grew up, there's a museum, like, on the Downlands, which is an area known for shepherding in the 19th century. And it's like a history and natural history museum of the South Downs. And there is one of those interactive statues. So they recorded an actor doing a monologue as a Victorian shepherd, and it's not a very sophisticated talking statue. It's like a plain glass statue, and then somehow, like, it lights up and there's a face in it.
Oh, the weird, creepy ones where they, like, project a face onto a mannequin kind of thing.
Yeah, yeah, it was kind of that.
Oh, I hate those.
But it was dressed in a smock frock, which I think was original, and, like, a big hat. And it used to just absolutely startle the lights out of me every time. Because it was just... It would start, like, out of nowhere, and then it would go through its thing, and then it would deactivate, and then a few minutes later, it would just appear again.
That's not good. I don't like that.
Yeah. That's a good guy. I like that guy. Okay, here we go. This picture is entitled Mary Jane's Young Man, and it is a young man in a nice traditional looking smock frock, with smocking across the upper chest and a big wide collar, and he's wearing a neckerchief and a nice hat.
A big floppy hat. I love yes. it. It's how yeah. hats should be.
Yeah, so I'll put these pictures on the Tumblr as well, because or you can go to the V&A website, Victoria and Albert Museum, and just search smocking in the collection search bar, and there's a whole wealth of stuff. Yeah, some really, really beautiful smock frocks. There's a lot of, like, more embroidered and decorated ones on there where the smocking is, like, in a pattern as well as having other embroidery. So I don't know whether that's, like, it's more likely the fancier ones have ended up being kept and donated to the museum, because I can't see so many of the plainer ones. But then some of the fancier looking ones have, like, stains on them and signs of wear that look like they've had use. So
maybe that's just when you finally give them to the museum.
Maybe.
Like, I'll see what your conservators can do with that big blob of jam.
Lick it.
Don't lick the artifacts.
What? How are you going to get the full picture otherwise?
I admit I did not do the conservation module. But I'm gonna take a wild guess. You should not lick the historical clothing.
You can lick some of the artifacts. Anyway, so those were quite popular throughout the 19th century, and then they kind of fell out of use with, like, the shift away from agriculture so much. Like, it's harder to wear a loose flowing garment if you're working in a factory. Just as they sort of started to fall out of use as a working garment, smocking itself, the technique, became, like, a high fashion thing. So it made that jump. And one of the reasons for this is that the aesthetic movement and the arts and crafts movement was happening.
Oh, and that makes sense.
Yeah.
Cottagecore.
Yeah, kind of Victorian cottagecore. So that was, like, to do with the Pre-Raphaelites as well, and the movement away from, like, the constraining sort of high Victorian values and back to a more natural and, like, looking back towards history, like, method of art and media and part of this. I mean,
towards an interpretation of history, let's say.
Yeah. A very romanticized version of medieval history. But yeah, part of this was the aesthetic dress movement, which was meant to be less constraining, more practical, more healthy. And you didn't have to wear a corset. So smocking was quite popular because not only did it look a bit cottagecore, it also was a way to shape the garment, but without being too constricting.
Yeah, so I guess if you're not going in for like all of the sort of padding and corseting and stuff, but you still want some kind of shape to what you're wearing, it's kind of the only real option.
Yeah, and I guess with a lot of the aesthetic like dresses and things being quite there's quite a lot of fabric, like they're quite flowy, kind of like the romantic medieval styly. It kind of fits as a way to control that. I didn't realize, but Liberty London made some absolutely cracking dresses during this period.
It doesn't surprise me because they keep popping up when I'm looking at various fashion trends as just like, and also here's some stuff Liberty did.
Yeah, they seem to be quite on the pulse. So here's one. It's a blue dress. It's made, it's 1893 or 4, and it is, I think this one's made of silk. It is, yeah.
So the smocking's almost like where you'd have stays.
Yeah, like the smocking is around the waist, kind of like those pointy, really cinched Victorian belts. But it's part of the dress, and it's just like smocked in, and it's clearly not that, it's not super cinched in. But it does give the shape to the dress.
Mm-hmm.
And it's one of those.
And it outlines the breasts quite nicely.
It does. It does. It shows off the assets. but it's still got that kind of big Victorian skirt thing going on. It's just a lot more sort of drapey and it does look quite comfy, actually.
Yeah, I'd wear that.
Yeah.
I can see lounging with a book in my magnificent library in that dress.
Aesthetically next to a window.
Mm-hmm.
There is one more example here. Okay, I can't figure out how to copy that, so I'm just gonna put the link there. But this one is a velvet.
Oh gosh, that's very brown.
Yeah, it's smocking on velvet, and the smocking is around the collar as well as the waist. And there's quite an extensive use of smocking. It's in pattern as well.
Yeah, it's like a pointed yoke.
Yeah, it's the yoke. So yeah, it like gathers in all of that fabric. And I guess there's not as much need for like shaping via cutting as well.
Mm-hmm.
Although it might also be tailored, I'm not sure. That was the heyday of the artistic dress movement, and then it did continue to be used. I think like folksy style fashion was also quite popular in the 30s and 40s. It was quite a popular handcraft as well. It is actually on the register of the endangered craft.
Was it? Yeah, another one. I think we've posted that on the Tumblr before.
Yeah, I think we have. I'll get back to you on that one. But yeah, it kind of went out of fashion for a while again, and then the 70s happened, and like back to the roots. Kind of folksy stuff was all the rage again, except now we have plenty of elastic. So to save time, a lot of the like big fashion brands would kind of do mock smocking by using elastic to do shirring, which is where it's more of a like a gathering thread goes through, and that is what brings the fabric in. But it kind of looks like smocking, especially if you add a few touches.
Yeah.
And it's super stretchy, obviously. And that still gets used a lot today. But yeah, that's that's where I'm going to kind of leave it. I mean, I think like many crafts, it's kind of coming back again, but I haven't seen it quite as popular as other forms of embroidery. But I don't know, if you're a person who does smocking, then please let us know. Send us some pictures of your work. We will reblog it or whatever. It would be cool to see.
Definitely.
RBG ideas should be good, right? But what this podcast supposes is, maybe they don't have to be. The Probably Bad Podcast brings you ideas like dire humans fight your GM in real life. And what if there is an eye laser man? Listen to the Probably Bad Podcast, available everywhere podcasts exist, and some places where they don't.
So, yeah, that's about where I'm at with smocking. What is the local larder for today?
I thought I would have a look at wasabi.
Ooh, spicy.
Yeah, because I keep coming across this like fun fact that most wasabi outside of Japan isn't wasabi.
I've heard that one, yeah.
So then I was like, well, what is wasabi?
I'm excited to find out what it really is and whether is it true that most wasabi outside Japan is not actually wasabi?
Yeah, most wasabi outside of Japan is a mixture of horseradish, mustard, and food coloring.
Ah, okay. So what is real wasabi?
So wasabi, it is related to horseradish. And also mustard. It's one of those.
Okay.
The brassicas that just sort of show up everywhere. But it's a specific kind with a green coloured rhizome, which is a kind of root. That, to be fair to the wasabi fakers, is often compared to mustard or horseradish. That is native to, we think, Japan, Korea, and easternmost Russia. That kind of line. And actually still does grow in the wild in Japan.
Oh, that's cool. So you can have wild wasabi.
So in terms of historical wasabi, the first evidence that we have of it is probably... because obviously we don't have exact dates when you go back far enough. From the Asuka period, which is approximately 645 to 715, that kind of range.
Okay, and pretty old.
Is actually they found little wooden strips with the names of various herbs and medicinal plants on, including one that said wasabi. So they think that it might be from like a herb garden, which I really love that the first evidence we have of it is just, here's my little herb garden, here's where my wasabi is.
That's so domestic. My little wasabi patch.
And that's from Nara Prefecture. And then in Japan's oldest medical encyclopedia, which is from the Heian period, which is 806 to... Yeah, the Heian period is about 9th to 12th century. We have the oldest Japanese medical encyclopedia.
That's cool.
It refers to wasabi as a treatment for respiratory disorders, which is one of those things where you can kind of see where they came to it, because it's one of those very, like, feels like it's clearing out your sinuses kind of spices, with it being sort of that horseradishy, mustardy kind of spice. So it shows up in a lot of medical recipes.
I can see that. Like, you also, sometimes you can feel kind of good after having spice.
Oh yeah, like where if I've got a really bad cold, I will be like, I will make a curry or something like that. And it also shows up in the Engishiki, which is the oldest Japanese law book from about 927. Because it specifically talks about it being one of the things you can pay your tax in some areas. So oh, similar wow. to how you have people paying taxes in grains and things like that, you can also pay in wasabi.
I guess you could in like salt you could pay. So yeah, wasabi.
Yeah, just anything valuable, really. But wasabi is one of those things.
I want to know what happened to the taxpayer's wasabi.
I guess it was probably just enjoyed by the people they were paying taxes to.
Yeah.
So we'd then jump forward to the Edo period, which you've probably heard of. Because that's the period that's sort of associated with samurai and things like that, is the Edo period. We start getting it actually being cultivated. Which I find it interesting that it's that long between it being this is a great wild growing thing. Because, I mean, it's specifically mentioned as being wild in the 12th century.
Mm-hmm.
But eventually people do start actually cultivating it. When we get up to sort of the 1500s, the Tokugawa shogunate basically going, this is really great. We should be cultivating this. And the shogun actually ordering his staff to plant wasabi at Suruga Castle.
Oh, so you get big wasabi.
You get big wasabi, yeah.
I like the idea of like a whole wasabi garden, though.
And there's a theory that part of the reason that the Tokugawa family were so into it was because the leaves look really similar to the hollyhock, which is that family's crest. That this is when it starts to be used more in just for cooking rather than specifically for medicinal purposes. Until we get to the Bunsei era of the Edo period. So we're talking early 1800s.
Mm-hmm.
When it starts being used as a condiment for sushi. Possibly because people know that it can act as a preservative, and obviously if you've got sushi with raw fish in it, you want something that will prevent that kind of decay. And that's kind of how it obviously then gets introduced more to the West as sushi becomes popular in sort of the 1970s.
Yeah, because I think, like, I know it mainly as just, like, the thing that goes with sushi.
Yeah. But eventually particularly in the 70s is when you start getting the little packets of wasabi paste that you can have with the little packets of wasabi paste that are basically better preserved because it's a grated root, so you need a way to preserve it, especially once refrigeration comes in, it's a lot easier.
Mm-hmm.
And in the 20s, you start getting powdered wasabi.
Oh.
Which I've realised I've got the dates slightly mixed around there, but yeah, so powdered wasabi, again, a good way of preserving it, and then you can, like with mustard, you can make that back up by adding a bit of water to make it back into the paste.
Mm-hmm.
And it has kind of made its way back to that medicinal use. There's a company called Kinjirushi, which makes cosmetics with wasabi extract in.
Oh, wow.
Cosmetics. As sort of an antioxidant skin detox kind of thing. Which I haven't been able to find much on whether that actually works, but it's sure a thing you can buy.
Yeah, I did it. Putting the spicy thing on my face. I mean, I guess I have no reason to think it wouldn't be good.
It is important to note that it's wasabi extract. So it's presumably not the spicy part.
Yeah.
Although, I don't know. People do all sorts of things in pursuit of beauty.
Be tingly.
Maybe the tingle shows it's working.
Yeah.
So that is the brief introduction to wasabi. Oh.
I would like to one day try some real wasabi.
So if you would like to maybe contribute to Hazel getting some of the fancy imported wasabi, you can support us on Patreon at patreon.com/breadandthread. And also get access to a Discord server and monthly recipes.
The recipes are good. You can also find us on Tumblr at Bread and Thread, where there are pictures of things that we talk about on the podcast, teasers for upcoming episodes, and we sometimes have the conversation on there. We have Whip Wednesday. We reblog things that are relevant to the remit of our podcast.
And I think I'm going to do another bracket soon. We did the bread bracket.
Oh, that was good.
I'm going to do another bracket.
Yeah. What should we do this time?
Dumplings.
Ooh, that one is going to get controversial.
I'm going to start a war on the Tumblr. It'd be great.
A bun fight.
Oh, terrible.
That might have been better on the bread one, but what are dumplings if not tiny buns?
Yeah. I mean, I've seen Bao referred to as buns.
Yeah, exactly.
If you want to suggest an episode or correct my Japanese pronunciation, I did look it up. You can message us on the Tumblr, which is just Bread and Thread, or email breadandthreadpodcast@gmail.com.
Thank you very much for listening, and we will see you next time.